Welcome back to part two of my conversation with Justin Guarini. He's already shared pivotal moments from his childhood and given us a cautionary tale of his college experience. So we pick up with his decision to stick with American Idol instead of making his Broadway debut in The Lion King.
I literally called up Bender Casting and I said, "Thank you so very much. This has been a dream of mine to be on Broadway, but there's something about this show that I'm going to go with it." And that was a huge fork in the road for me, and I chose American Idol.
This is Why I'll Never Make It, or Win Me for short. Here you'll learn how artists and creatives handle the setbacks and challenges that come with a career in the performing arts. I'm your host, Patrick Oliver Jones, a professional actor and backstage expert who knows firsthand the ups and downs we all face. In fact, Justin Guarini has written a book to help us actors through one of the most stressful but also most necessary parts of this business, auditioning. And if you would like to have a signed copy of his book, Audition Secrets, then all you have to do is go to whyillnevermakeit.com and join as either a maker, producer, or artist. Sign up for one of these memberships between now and the end of this month, January 2021, and one lucky winner will get Justin's tips and secrets to auditioning. Again, go to whyillnevermakeit.com for your chance to win this signed copy of Audition Secrets. You'll also find a link in the show notes. Well, speaking of auditioning, so many of us actors in New York and elsewhere for that matter, long for and look forward to that day when Broadway calls. Justin had that moment and was given the opportunity to realize one of his biggest dreams. Yet, he turned it down. At that moment, after you made that phone call, what was there? Was there doubt? Was there regret? Was there like, oh my gosh, what did I just do?
No, I don't remember there being any of that. I just, there are times when I will listen to that voice that pops into my head. I try and do it as much as I can now and have a decent success rate. But that was a moment I was like, this is it. Okay. So I made my choice, and there's something that happens. And I know everyone has experienced this. When you make a decision, and it's a scary decision, but when you decide, there's that lifting of, it's not a problem anymore.
Yeah, it's like, okay, this is what I'm doing.
This is what I'm doing. And so, okay, all of my energy is going to go here. And that's exactly what happened for me. All of my energy went into it. I tried to be the very best that I could be. I enjoyed it. And it catapulted my career in ways that I still am reaping the rewards for.
And so that second moment that I wanted to ask is, after American Idol, you came up second, and did you ever look back and be like, maybe I should have done Lion King? Have you ever thought about that?
No. I mean, I have thought about it. But those months after the lights went down on American Idol, it was like, I went from zero to about 6,000 miles an hour from when I just first started auditioning for American Idol to the finale of American Idol. Right. And then from there, it was just like warp speed after that. Because once the lights went down, Kelly and I literally got on a plane. We went to New York, did the Today Show, and like all the press that you could possibly do the day after. And then it was from there, it was like we did the Vegas show. There was a national tour after that. It was warp speed, singing. I was taking 8 plane rides in 7 days, sort of like just everything was crazy. And it's something that I could have only done in my early 20s, right? But I have thought about what would have happened had I been like, you know what? Forget this whole thing. I'm going to do The Lion King. Maybe I would have auditioned the next year when it was Clay and Ruben. But I always think like, you know what? That Lion King stage is raked. And for those who don't know what a raked stage is, it's just a stage that, you know, most stages are flat. But because certain set designers and just people who want you to see what's going on at the back of the stage, upstage. They will tilt the stage, the back, they'll raise the back of the stage. So basically you're on an angle when you're on the stage that makes you feel like you're kind of falling towards the audience. And so there are many elements on that stage that are raked. And I figure, what would have happened if I had gone and I just, and injuries are a huge part of The Lion King. A lot of people come out of that show with injuries. And so,
because those puppet apparatuses are heavy, they're cumbersome. Yes. As beautiful as they are, they still are a lot to carry. Yeah. Yes. So, injuries are a big part of that. So, who knows?
Exactly.
And so, even though you came in second place, this was kind of a public loss. I'm doing air quotes.
Yes, absolutely.
And then from Justin to Kelly was not well received. No. That's putting it very gently.
So kind. So you're so kind.
What feels like, or what seems like, setbacks or losses, it sounds like you were still in the throes of it and it was still catapulting and lifting up what your performing career came to be, right?
Yeah. It's so interesting looking back on it now, because I see this sort of epic rise and then this just slow public descent into madness for me. And I grew up in LA, basically, from 2002 until about, I would say maybe 2008. I spent time in the wasteland of LA. And I learned everything that I was not supposed to do, how I was not supposed to behave. I learned all of the lessons, and it was just an epic time of, air quotes, failure for me, because I got to, you know, I was the number one male on American Idol that first season, you know what I mean? I came in second, and that's huge. I got a record deal out of it. There was a movie, there was a tour, and the tour itself was great. That was it. That was the pinnacle. Because I was singing to 30,000 people every single night. It was just me on the stage at certain points. And it was just right. It was what I pointed at. I was pointing at myself.
Your 8-year-old self is like, I'm here,
yes,
I'm here.
Like, you're there, right? That was it. And then everything just sucked after that. The movie tanked. My album tanked. There were just moments in the press where I just became the butt of the joke. I mean, just everyone, all the late night, everything. I found out that I was dropped from my record label when I was watching SNL one night and Weekend Update came on and Tina Fey started into her monologue and my picture came up next to her head there. And she said, today in the news, Justin Guarini was dropped from his record label. And now he looks like this. And then they switched it to a picture of Art Garfunkel, which I can laugh about now, right?
Yeah,
but at the time I was like, wait, what? And so it was such a strange time, because I was living in a mansion that was not my own, but I was living in a mansion in Bel Air, right? Like, it was like Fresh Prince time for me. And yet I was the most miserable I've ever been. I had, there were literal maids. And so I could leave my clothes on the floor and the very next day they would be cleaned and folded in the walk-in closet that was in my wing of this house. And yet I never felt more alone. I never felt less cared for, or cared about. And it was just awful. And then slowly extricated myself from that situation. I got out of my American Idol contracts, out of the record contracts after they dropped me, out of all that. And I literally just left the country. I went to New Zealand and I jumped out of an airplane and I bungee jumped and I did anything and everything I could to feel alive again, because I just felt so dead inside from that experience of feeling like I'm doing the work. Like, I'm giving them what they want. They're supposed to take care of me, but that's not how it works. I didn't know that.
It's always that interesting moment. It was the same thing with school. It was like, what's school going to do for me? What's American Idol going to do for me? Yes. What is this record contract going to do for me? You were looking, and then you finally realized no one is doing for you what you have to do for yourself.
And that is such a huge lesson to learn. And I, fortunately or unfortunately, had to learn it through a lot of public failure. or humiliation at certain points. And yet once I started getting out of that, I got to keep the fame, but then I began to do other things that were outside of singing and acting. I was always singing and began to audition in LA. But I actually went back to my roots, which was I got a show hosting in studio, basically what you would consider like E or Extra, one of those sort of news shows, but it was all about American Idol. And so it was myself and Kimberly Caldwell and Rosanna Tavares, who was another reality singing competition person. Kimberly Caldwell was on, I think, season 3 or 4 of American Idol. And so the three of us were hosting this show that was all about American Idol because it was still the hottest thing on television. And with that company, TV Guide Network, I not only got to host that show, but then I got to host live red carpets for the Grammys and the Emmys and the Oscars. And like, so I got to be in it and people recognized me on the red carpet. And there was something really cool about interviewing these extremely famous people who would talk to me in a way that wasn't like they would talk to other sort of reporters, right? Because I felt like we were kind of in the club, like, oh, he's one of us. And so there was something really cool to that that gave me back a lot of confidence and a lot of just faith and belief that I had lost. And so that went on from there for years.
So what eventually brought you back to musical theater?
You know, just being tired of LA. I had 3 or 4 really good friends out there. And then as far as I'm concerned, everybody else could go to hell because it just was a mess of people who just were all there for the same reason. And I love to put it in this terms, when you're in New York and somebody says, hey, what do? Subtext of that is, hey, how can I relate to you? Right? How can we have a conversation? When you're in LA, what do? The subtext for that is, what can I gain by knowing you? Who do you know that I can get? And so I just got so sick and tired of it. I was done. And I had the Christmas before flown back and through a series of events met up with a girl that I had known for forever. And we ended up dating and we ended up falling in love. And for 6 months, I moved back home because I was like, look, I'm tired of LA. I want to be with this girl. And for 6 months, I would commute back and forth to LA to do red carpets or do sort of performances here and there. And then I just said, you know what? I am staying on the right coast. And I auditioned for this show called Women on the Verge of Nervous Breakdown, a Broadway show. And I ended up getting it. And it was my Broadway debut.
Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown first came out in 1988 as a Spanish black comedy drama film starring Antonio Banderas. It even received an Oscar nomination for Best Foreign Language Film. The musical is based on that film and was written by David Yazbek and opened on Broadway November 4th, 2010. And it had a star-studded cast. I mean, just listen to these names. Sherry Renee Scott, Laura Benanti, David Burstein, and of course, Patti LuPone and Brian Stokes Mitchell, who played Justin's parents in the show. Luis Salgado, who you'll remember from last season during Hispanic Heritage Month, was in the ensemble. And one of the understudies in the show was Rachel Bay Jones, who would go on to win the Tony Award for Featured Actress in Dear Evan Hansen. So Justin was in amazing company for his Broadway debut. But ultimately, it was a return to theater, a return to New York, with a sense of nervousness and wonderment, and even a sense of questioning his own place in such a stellar cast.
Yeah, all of that. But again, ignorance being bliss. Really, truly. I mean, nothing really encapsulates, because I was so in LA. I was in La La Land in music and production and TV world that I had completely missed so much of what was happening on Broadway. And I think what really encapsulates it is one day in rehearsal, Laura Benanti and Patti LuPone were talking. And, you know, I just saw they had they just had this great friendship. And I was like, hey, so how do you two know one another? Ugh. And little did I know, the season before, they both won Tonys for being in the show together. And I was like, oh, when I found that out, I felt really stupid. But I mean, that was it. Like, I had no idea. And so I knew that I was like, okay, I gotta step it up. But what was really beautiful was they taught me, and I mean they, meaning everyone in that cast, taught me so much about etiquette. They gave me a crash course in acting. They gave me a crash course in all the things that are just the height of what it means to be a professional in musical theater. It's like so many of the things that, you know, you go back to college, what can this do for me? What can American Idol do for me? When I went into that rehearsal situation, I knew that I had to do for this show. I had to step up because there were all these people, right. Just the table read. I was like, oh, these people are serious. And so I knew that it wasn't about what can this show do for me? It's what can I do for this show? And the ensemble of all of these amazing people, they really took me under their wing. And for example, I was reading for the very first time in rehearsal my scene with Patti LuPone, the first scene that we have. And she's sitting and I'm standing and we have this mother-son conversation. And she says her line. I wait. I say my line. She says her line. I think about what she says. And I say my line. Mm-hmm. And at one point, I mean, straight out of Blanche DuBois' playbook, she had this fan that just went, and as I was taking one of my pauses to think about what she said, she starts fanning herself with this. And at the end of the scene, she taught me, and again, it was this only how Patty can teach you. She taught me timing because at the end of the scene, we were done and she turned to me and she said, Justin, you could drive a truck through this scene. Which was her, and she liked me, thank God, which was her way of saying, pick up the cues. Come on. So, Justin, you could drive a truck through this scene.
Please give me a reason to not use my fan between every line.
Oh, and so sometimes I had to learn the hard way like that. But there was other times when Patty pulled me aside and she said, hey, make sure you learn all of the crew members' names, because in 6 months, when you need something, hey, you is not going to work. And these people are vital to us. So like she would take me and taught me things, and everybody would just, it was the most beautiful experience, and also, you know, tragic because it just didn't do well commercially.
That's right. Despite its cast being a who's who of Broadway, Women on the Verge only lasted 2 months on Broadway. Basically, the show baffled critics and couldn't find an audience. And that's a 1-2 punch that is pretty much impossible for any show to overcome.
You know, it was the right show for the wrong audience. It was Lincoln Center Theater, which tends to skew an older subscription base. And Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, if you watch the film, as many of Almodovar's films, for the first 20 minutes of that film, you have no idea what's going on. It's in black and white. It's wild. And so the musical followed that same format where it was just kind of this freewheeling, we don't kind of know what's going on, and we're building the world. And so many of the people, the feedback that I heard from the older people in the audience is like, what's going on? I don't know what's going on. They don't know what's happening. And when you don't capture an audience within the first 20 minutes of your show, you're not going to last long.
It sounds like that this was really a crash course in collaboration, in working with others, in kind of driving that point home that you've been learning about what can I bring to the table rather than what can be done for me.
Absolutely. They taught me the proper etiquette of how to collaborate respectfully. Phrases like, hey, if this is okay with you, would you mind if we tried this? And just how to operate in the old school Broadway way. Gorgeous. So fortunate that I got to just go to lunch all the time with Stokes, Brian Stokes Mitchell, and to be around Patti LuPone and to just chit chat with her about, you know, things she did in Evita and just certain, you know, there were certain times that she said to me, because I was like, I don't know if I'll ever understand this line. And she said, Justin, there was a show where it wasn't until the closing night that I said a line that I finally understood what it meant. And so those sort of pieces and pearls of wisdom from such amazing people in that cast that I was blessed to have. And then, funny enough, the very next show that I did was Green Day's American Idiot, which is like the polar opposite.
Completely different. Right, right. As they say, when one door closes, another opens. So even though Women on the Verge closed rather quickly, just a couple of months later, Justin joined the cast of American Idiot. But his next Broadway show was a completely different production and involved no music at all. William Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet. And it was another star-studded cast, including Jeffrey Owens from The Cosby Show, who you'll actually be hearing on the podcast later this season. So once again, Justin found himself surrounded by all this wonderful talent, and to be honest, was completely surprised when he was cast in the production.
I mean, out of nowhere, nobody gets cast in plays. Like, that's the thing. Like, it's so impossible because obviously there are so few of them. Usually they're smaller casts. And like, most of the actors that get cast in plays are like, they are the actors who do plays. Like, this is their thing. And yet here I was being cast as... And I don't know how it happened. I just went and I did the audition. And I guess maybe it was for Paris. And Romeo and Juliet is my all-time favorite story. Matter of fact, my ring, my wedding ring, is the ring that is from the Baz Luhrmann version that Romeo gives to Juliet that they exchange. And so that is the ring that I have as my wedding. So, like, obviously, I love this show. I prepared really for it. And David LeBeau cast me. And again, I was a part of this amazing cast. You know, Orlando Bloom, Condola Rashad, Chuck Cooper, Brent Carver. I mean, just Jane Houdyshell, like some of the most amazing people. Again, this just wonderful, wonderful actors. And here I was playing Paris and with Dave LeVeau, who's just a brilliant and savvy director. And I'm doing Shakespeare. It has just been such a wild progression for me. And then I would go on from that to do Fierro and Wicked, like the most commercial show ever, right?
In what seems to be a trend in Justin's career, he actually auditioned for the Broadway and touring companies of Wicked back in 2004, and they offered him the tour, but he was unable to do it due to scheduling conflicts. However, Wicked director Joe Mantello and producer David Stone saw Justin in Romeo and Juliet and put him on the short list as a Fierro replacement. So Shakespeare actually led to Justin being in Wicked. You just never know how one opportunity will lead to the next. So getting to In Transit, that's almost back to your choral singing together kind of background that you had, mixing in with a little bit of the jazz that you discovered. You know, so it seems like you're going back to your high school, college days of the kind of music that you grew up with.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And In Transit holds a very special place in my heart, not only because it was a show that I got to originate the role in, but it was a show that harkened back to my days in high school when me and seven or eight other guys got together. And we formed a group called the Midnight Voices. It was a male a cappella group. And the backstory behind that is, for my high school, there's a tradition. Every night before graduation, a bunch of guys from the men's ensemble, you know, the select choir, would go, and girls that they knew, girls that they liked, girls that were dating, we would go at midnight and, you know, pebbles at the window, and they would open the window and we would sing to them. We would serenade them. And so that was a tradition that was passed down to me and to a bunch of my friends. And then we were like, well, wait, let's make this a thing. And so we formed this a cappella group and we went to a competition and like all this thing. And then we made an album. We were literally in the basement of my friend's church with all these microphones. And it was so long ago, we recorded it on DAT, which is digital audio tape. I mean, this is telling you,
yeah.
Look it up, folks, because it is, it's like, it's the VCR of audio recording. And so it's so like, here I was, oh, so many years later, getting to be in the Broadway's first a cappella musical. So I was like, yes, this, I want, yes, we are doing this. I can't believe it. And then if you know who Deke Sharon is, just a brilliant music that he comes up with, but it is, was, and forever will be the most difficult show I have ever learned. I have never been in a rehearsal situation where I'm 3 days in, and not just me, not just the people next to me, but everybody's looking around thinking, I don't know if we're going to be able to do this, guys. This is so hard, because we were the show. It was it. There was no music. There was no nothing. We were the show. All the transition music that you hear, all the sound effects, all the everything was the human voice. And so 90 out of 100 minutes of the show, I was singing. And I had never done that before. And I was with, fortunately, some amazing, some of those workhorse just leaders in our Broadway community were my castmates. And we put our heads down and we just did it. And where normally you're given about 3 weeks worth of rehearsal to put a show together, and then you go into tech and then you go into previews, we had about 5 weeks worth of rehearsal because of the breadth of the music. Then we did tech. And then not only we did tech, but we did it Circle in the Square in New York. So it's theater in the round. And so it's just like so many complicated things, but it was, and will forever, probably forever, be my most favorite show I've ever done, because it was a labor of love.
Right, right. And I got to see that show. It was very interesting. After coming out of the show, I loved it for its newness and for what it was trying to be. Now, in some places, it succeeded wonderfully. In others, it didn't quite. And so I think the creative team knew that, and they were just trying to figure out ways to balance that out.
It was just a challenge on so many different levels, because not only are you dealing with a cappella, period, which is a treacherous road at the best of times, because it's one of those things where there are 12 people on stage, and if just one of them is slightly flat or sharp, the entire thing sounds strange. And then we had, for the very first time, this was something that I did on tour all the time in the pop world, in-ear monitors. Something that like you just don't do on Broadway. Not only because we were in such disparate places on the stage that we couldn't hear one another like you need to hear one another. So we had these in-ear monitors, and we spent an entire week of tech, and the poor woman who was on the soundboard must have just wanted to jump out a window because every single song, let's say there's like, you know, 15 songs in the show. Every single one of them has to have 12 separate mixes for 12 separate actors. So, I mean, it's like it's just multiples in terms of the variance that you can have. And every single song has a different mix based on where people are and what they're doing. And all. It was all of that. And it was so many, many things. And then you have to think, okay, in a normal show, you have standbys, people going in and out, and it is what it is. But in an a cappella show, you have 12 people who sound a very specific way together. But when you remove one of those pieces and replace it with another, it changes that sound for everyone. And then when you have two or three of those pieces going out, because look, I have never taken steroids as many times as I have in that show. It's a rarity when you get worn down. It, which often happens in a Broadway show, you'll go to the doctor and they'll give you steroids, which will help reduce inflammation for your vocal cords, right? And it helps a lot.
Because your voice is just tired. It is spent. Yes. It is exhausted.
That's it. And it is part of what got Julie Andrews in trouble.
This vocal overexertion that Justin is talking about is something that many singers experience who push their voices to the limit. I've even had my own bouts with it. And it makes the voice tired and difficult to produce sound. It can even result in more serious issues like vocal cord lesions or cysts, nodules or polyps. And it was in 1997, after 2 years with the Broadway musical Victor Victoria, that Julie Andrews had been diagnosed with a lesion on her vocal cords. And she described this weak spot more like a cyst. So once the show closed, Andrews was actually looking forward to giving her voice a rest. However, the production team wanted her to headline the Victor Victoria National Tour. In an interview with Hollywood Reporter back in 2015, she said, quote, "I knew it was wrong to do it. I didn't respect my voice enough, and I said yes. And then it went downhill from there, believe me." What was assumed to be a simple procedure to alleviate that weak spot in her vocal cords ultimately ended her 4-octave range and singing career. Andrews says she will always regret that surgery, but she's had to learn to forgive herself for doing it because she felt such an obligation to the show and production team. Later this season, I'll be doing an episode on vocal maintenance and the stress and tension we put on our vocal cords. It's become a very personal issue for me in my own voice, and this was a lesson that Justin and the cast of In Transit was learning as well.
So many of us went down because it was just non-stop singing. You're backstage singing. And one story, Margot Seibert, who was our leading lady, had one point in the show where she had to literally look at Jerry-Ann Perez, who was another member of the show, and they would have to look at one another and coordinate Jerry-Ann taking over Margot's note that she was singing. It was like, ooh, and they'd have to coordinate taking that note over so that Margot could stop singing while Jerry-Ann continued on with the singing, take off, do a costume change, get a drink of water, put it back on, look at Jerry-Ann, and then slowly ooh, and take over her part, and then we'd run off to different places of the stage. There was so much coordination and things that went on and just terror backstage that it became unsustainable. It just became unsustainable.
Oh my gosh. I'm wondering the kind of lessons that they learned from doing this first a cappella musical.
We were birthing something so totally new that nobody really knew how to market it. There was a beautiful ad campaign that came out that had our pictures inside of the word sing. And yet, unfortunately, that same year, there was a cartoon that was sing, right? And so they missed the boat there. And then from a production perspective, we had never ever, I mean, in-ear monitors and the type of choreography, and there was a conveyor belt that brought things on and off the stage, and we were doing it in the round. Like, there were so many complications there that Kathleen Marshall had to deal with and that the creatives had to deal with. And when you think just from musically on the production side, there were rewrites that were happening, and it's one thing... It's one thing to deal with rewrites in a regular show, right? But you have these extremely complicated arrangements of songs that you've learned, and then you do them at night, but then you want to do changes during previews, and you're having to learn a whole new arrangement during the day, but then do the old arrangement at night, and then at certain days later, you have to switch and do the new arrangement and forget about the old. It's just like, oh.
I've never done a Broadway show, but that is the one thing about a Broadway show that I'm one of those actors that it takes me a while to kind of figure out my lane. And then once I'm there, I'm in my lane and I wear a deep path into that lane. And to change it is like tearing up the ground beneath me. And I don't know where I'm going or what I'm doing. So I can only imagine what it's like to have a 12-part chord and be like, you know what, this one and that one needs to come out. And so now these other two are going to flip flop and then we're going to change that. Oh yeah. And say different lines. Go.
Terrifying.
Yeah.
Absolutely terrifying. But again, it's just what we do. Mm-hmm. I don't care if you're on a cruise ship. I don't care if you're in a regional show or on Broadway or in a church show or Lord knows Summerstock. I mean, just a few years ago, I was asked to learn an entire new musical at the Bucks County Playhouse, which is right down the road from where I live, an entire new musical in 3 days. Blocking, music, all the autography, and the sides and everything. And I did it because the actor who was in the role was injured, and they know that I live close by, and they're like, hey, please, can you come do this? And I learned it. And of course, I had a little like tiny cheat sheet, but I learned the entire musical, all of it. I mean, it is just the type of trauma that we are trained to deal with. Yeah. It is. And so we do it, and we don't know how we do it. And we look back and we're like, I don't know how I survived, but we did it. We do it, and we continue to do it. And it's just so many wonderful, beautiful lessons learned.
And it sounds like that you found your life in theater.
Yes.
A deeper sense of it than you ever found in that pop world.
Absolutely. I found a community that I felt accepted in. You know, of all the communities and all the ways that I felt that I wasn't accepted in my life and in the pop community or whatever, you know, the reality TV community, it was the musical theater community that made me, and still to this day, makes me feel the most accepted and the most loved.
And so in this journey that we've been on, what is making it? What does that level of success mean to you?
Making it, I don't think I'll ever make it. That's what I know about making it. Mm. If I've made it, I feel like that's almost death. There's something about that that speaks to atrophy. When you feel like, oh, I made it. That's it. I'm done. So making it to me is really literally the making it. Like you make the process of doing it. That's what making it means to me. And as long as I'm continuing to evolve and grow and learn and, you know, absorb information around me, that's making it to me. I want to continue to make art. I want to continue to make improvements. I want to continue to help people avoid the traps and pitfalls that I've fell into and to make the type of curriculum that will help people to, you know, discover their own version of making it.
And are there any particular, to kind of carry on this metaphor of that path, are there any dead ends that you can think of where it's like, this was a lesson I need to learn so that I could back up and go in this other direction?
Oh, yeah. I mean, my life and my career are just filled with them. Whether it's a show that didn't work out the way I wanted it to, or just trying something and failing so miserably. Really, that sort of, oh my goodness, just hitting a brick wall and then having to back up encapsulates the past 2 years of my life, because I saw, and it's like I just turned 42, so I turned 40 then, and I just see, you know, I'm not over the hill by any stretch of the imagination, but I see it. It's there on the horizon. I'm thinking, you know, either people are not going to want to see and hear from me, or I'm not going to want to be on that side of the camera or on that side of the stage. And so what can I do that still allows me to be in touch with this community and to influence and to share knowledge with this community? And that was to teach. But there's teaching, which I've done, but there's a whole online. And 2 years ago, I was like, there's online. There's something about virtual that I really want to get into. And so I started really discovering not only the virtual world, but the marketing and the advertising and the sales and the fulfillment and the optics and the accounting. And it has been 2 years, and just in the second week of November of last year, I was able to actually do a masterclass. It took 2 years to get people into a masterclass the way that I wanted to do it with the stuff that I wanted to teach them, because I had to trip and fall and try all kinds of other sort of masterclass ideas. And I wrote a book called Audition Secrets. And I mean, I did all these other things that didn't quite work out the way that I wanted them to, a podcast, all kinds of stuff that I was like, oh, gung-ho, I did. I wrote the book, I finished it, and I was like, okay, but there's more, but this is not quite it. I did all these interviews in the podcast, Audition Secrets, and I was like, man, and as you know, podcasting is its own job. Like, you could just, to be successful in a podcast, you just have to be a podcaster. Like, you know what I mean? That's it, right? That's what you do, for the most part, obviously. And so all these things, I was just like, oh, no. And then I finally have found, like you said, that lane where it's like, oh, okay, this makes sense. And what it really is it's online auditioning and self-taping and teaching people who are making that transition, especially now here in 2021, where at the time we're talking, Broadway still shut down.
Yep.
Film and TV is going. I mean, Vancouver is having a huge, just the Netflix is building studios. The work is there. But how do we help our people who are mostly used to walking into a room and doing things musical theater-wise, how do we help them transition into film and television? And that's part of what I love to do.
I love it. Well, thank you, Justin, for sharing your life and your little nuggets of wisdom that you've learned along the way. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Patrick. My pleasure. And I hope you have an awesome season.
Well, I couldn't have asked for a better way to start season 5 than with this conversation with Justin Guarini. His persistence and positive attitude have not only led to great opportunities in his life and career, but have also kept him going during those tough and challenging times. As I mentioned at the top of the episode, he has a book called Audition Secrets, which he also turned into a podcast. And it's all about helping artists sharpen our skills, overcome bad habits, and crush audition anxiety. So again, if you would like your chance to win a signed copy of that book, go to the website whyillnevermakeit.com and sign up for one of the Win Me memberships. A big thank you to Justin and to you for joining us in today's conversation. I'm your host, Patrick Oliver Jones, executive producer and host of the podcast. Dylan Adams is the booking producer. Music in this episode provided by Blue Dot Sessions and Vortex. My next guest is Lauren Ober, a podcast consultant, voice coach, and noted presenter on all things audio. She's the host of one of my favorite podcasts, Spectacular Failures. So join us next time as we talk more about why I'll never make it.